It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
This week is witness to two events, the ascendance of Donald Trump to the presidency and the national celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. This afternoon, Donald Trump will be sworn into office, making him the 45th president of the United States. At that moment, the first African-American president will leave office. Also this past week saw the nation celebrate the birthday of Martin Luther King, who would have been 88 years old. Much has changed in the country since his death in 1968, with a growing minority population who will soon be the majority in the coming decades, and the rise of the millennial generation, which now matches the baby boom numbers. So are we seeing a major shift in the nation? And if so, what may portend as we consider the King legacy and the rise of Donald Trump? This morning, we wanted to take a look at the state of the nation with our guest, Charlotte King. She is chair of the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice, also Amber Green with the Phoenix Youth Project, James Yamakawa with the group Show Up for Racial Justice, and Michael Weber with the Institute for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement on the campus of Salisbury University. And welcome to the program, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with the president, the current president, and at least the next few hours, President Obama, and whether or not we expected perhaps too much of him. I ran a couple of quotes that I saw, one from Jeffrey Richardson. He's the interim director of the Urban League of Bergen County in New Jersey. And he said, I thought when he, that is Obama, was elected, now people who thought of us all were bad seed can now see that all of us are not, that there was this hope and expectation that now I would not be followed in a store because of the color of the skin I'm in. And another quote I ran across, Melanie Price, Rutgers University professor, African Studies, also author of Race Whisper, Barack Obama and the Political Uses of Race. And she writes, white people who talk about race are not viewed the same way. Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, those are white people stepping outside themselves. And I want to start with you, Charlotte. Did we expect perhaps too much from the presidency of Barack Obama?
No, I think we underestimated him, and I think that's where the anger comes from. I think we expected much less, but he rose far, far above our expectations. And what could anger bigots more than to be contradicted in their traditional beliefs about what this man was incapable of doing? And turns out he was very capable.
What about you, Amber? Do you think we expected too much?
I think there was a point in time where the black community saw him as, you know, the fixer of all things. And because we have been waiting a long time to be in a position of power. And I think we were all just wrapped up in how glorified it was to have a black president, that we did put a lot of pressure on him to fix everything that was wrong with the black community and to turn over years and decades of, you know, racism, hardship, that segregation. It was decades of hurt and turmoil, and I think we thought he was going to get rid of it in 8 years. And you know, a lot of people, there's conversations saying that race relations have gotten worse since he's been elected, when really it's just been highlighted a lot more. Instead of, you know, the normal neon yellow highlighter is bright orange. You see it.
Charlotte, do you view it that way, that what we really see is just this stuff sort of surface, that they're really, it became from being invisible to being this bright orange?
Well, I think there's some credence to that. You know, it's gotten more highlighted, but it was there. It was there, and perhaps expecting him to resolve all the issues within the black community was an unfair expectation, given the fact that if he had done that, white America would have said, see, he's just interested in being a black president. Exactly. So he had a quite a balancing act to do. How do you become president for everyone in America and deal with those issues that are more personal?
James, I want to turn to you because
you still have this sort of disparity between, on the one hand, white folks who think that race relations have actually, and at least initially, had gotten better, and that African Americans had progressed a great deal. And one of the issues, obviously, that you've been dealing with is here in Salisbury with the lynching in 1931 that took place, in which people still don't seem to want to talk about it a lot. I don't know whether you expect it to come up before a city council meeting at all in terms of marking what happened. But what sense do you get about that, that relationship between African-American community and the white community, in particular the white community, being hesitant? People to have who admit past or admit that things are not quite what they should be?
Well, it's, I think with the past 8 years, it's, I mean, people in the white community have said, like, you know, that it's gotten worse. Race relations have gotten worse.
Right.
Just like Amber and Charlotte said, it's more about, like, you know, highlighting what's already been there. So it's, for those of us in the white community, it's been an awakening of sorts that we are, now we can't hide from it anymore. We can't hide from the situation as it is. And so it's more about, you know, coming to terms with the fact that this actually exists as opposed to trying to deny it. And denial is one of the biggest things we have to fight against, because if you deny that a problem is there, there's no possible way of even confronting it, let alone fixing it.
Charlotte, I was at a news conference the other day, yesterday, which forming a new civil rights coalition in Delaware, large number of both civil rights groups and religious groups coming together. And one of the things that one of the participants said is, they said, well, I want to thank Donald Trump because he brought all of this to the surface. And she even mentioned the fact there was some disagreement within the coalition itself, within the members, and they had apparently a contentious teleconference at one point. Do you think that that's the role that that Trump has played, and that that will reinvigorate perhaps civil rights groups and religious groups to fight against racism and to try to fight towards equality?
I'm very fearful. I don't know what's going to happen. I think Trump has always been Trump. I don't think it was his. I think he used, like many presidents have used, an agenda that appealed to the common mass. He appealed to people's hatreds. He appealed to people's bigotry. He appealed to the worst in all of us. And in all of us, there is the worst. I'm not sure that I want to give him credit. I think it could be expected that after 8 years of a black president, and there was hatred from the minute the Mr. Obama became president. I mean, some of our most famous commentators have said, we will not let him win. We will not let him succeed. You know, he was mistreated in his own Congress. And so it was always there. And I think the natural reaction to white America after 8 years of a black president is to elect a Donald Trump.
Amber, do you think that the various groups are going to be energized? I mean, obviously, we've seen a lot of protests. We talked a moment ago before the show that there are lots of protests. Black Lives Matter, obviously, has come to the fore. Do you think his presidency is going to invigorate, oddly, ironically?
Yeah, most definitely. Like, there has been a surge of energy going on through across the country, across the world right now because of Trump. And I don't want, I don't want to say it's, you know, he started it. I don't want to give him the credit. If I'm going to give credit to anybody, I'm going to give credit to Barack Obama for stepping up and leading this country and doing everything that he possibly can to bring us, to progress us more. We have become complacent as a country, as a community. We have come complacent to how we are. We think that we have reached a part of the golden era, and we have not. And I think it's time that a lot of people realize that, and a lot of people wake up. And that means black, white, Latino, Asian, everybody needs to wake up and see where we are as a country. As a country, we are divided. As a country, we've always been divided. Yes, we can, you know, we can have conversations. We can work together. We can be cordial. We can lead, and we can do things. We can do tasks together. But we are still divided personally. We are still divided in our homes. We're still divided, like, within the community. And I think Trump has just played off of the fact that, you know, since Barack Obama has become president, nobody wants to be led by a black man. That's unheard of. To be led by a black man on a mm-hmm. large stand, that is unheard of. To call a black man the commander in chief, to call the black man to determine whether or not if we are going to go to war or not, to ask a black man that shook America to the bone. And I think that is what woke everybody up, because a lot of people had to realize, wow, a black man is leading us. And here, decades, years ago, a black man was in chains and building this country up. A black man before was being whipped and being chained like a dog. Like, so you see the progress of a black man, but you don't want to, give credit to that progress.
To your generation, do you think it was complacent until this moment?
My generation? Yeah. I think we were letting the older generation just say, you know, they got it. They were good. And then I think when it started to affect us, when student loans started dictating whether or not I could get a job or whether or not I can feed my child or, you know, bills and everything, when that started affecting me and affecting a lot of my peers, we spend years in a college paying all this money, paying $300, $600 for books, trying to get an education to be in the shoes of generations before us. And we can't. And we can't because of the politicians that are in place right now. And because they are in place and they're holding they're basically jeopardizing our future. A lot of us said, hold on, you can't dictate our future. You can't dictate what we're doing. So a lot of us were like, you can't run our show anymore. This is our show. You guys had your time, and now we are. I was just looking on the internet, and I just realized that one of the D.C. city councilmen, his name is Trayon White. And when I saw a video of him, and he was talking about gentrification in Washington, D.C., I'm originally from there, and I was looking at him, and I was listening to him talk, and I was looking at his age. I was like, he has to be no more old, like maybe 3 or 4 years older than me. And I'm like, here he is as councilman. And I'm like, I could do that. And our generation is woken up. We're not waiting on anybody to feed us. We're not waiting on anybody to tell us what we can do. We're going to make the laws. We're going to fight for the laws that we want. And we're going to be heard. My dad always tells me, Amber, you're going to be heard. Whether you're wrong or right, you're going to be heard. And I am. And I appreciate this opportunity now that you have, you know, have me here speaking and having people hear my voice. Because as a young 26-year-old new mom, an African-American woman in 2017 in America, I have a lot of work to do.
Charlotte, are you encouraged by that, by her remarks?
I'm so encouraged by that, because that is the future of America. I mean, my group, and it's an interesting group, because the people, we thought it would be a diverse group. The people who come out are my generation, but they're white. And we keep saying, where are the black millennials? Where are the black youth? Because they're who we have to lay the responsibility of this country's growth and getting over themselves. And so it is wonderful, and I hope it's true, that this young 26-year-old mother is a symbol of what I can expect. You know, I want to pass off this earth feeling optimistic that she and others like her will take up the banner that Martin Luther King left us and continue.
Let me ask you this, Charlotte. How far do you think we've come? I was looking at some stats in terms of like median family income for African Americans. It's like $41,000. For everybody, it's something like $62,000. And it just goes on and on in terms of this. And certainly the income gap, and there are lots of other gaps. How far do you think King's dream has come? Have we overestimated how far much we could achieve, or what's your assessment? I mean,
go ahead. We have to agree the election of a black president, a fine black president, is a sign of progress. But unfortunately, we have to deal with the fact that while we elected our first black president, poverty has increased. Violence towards black people have increased. Lack of employment opportunities has increased. The growth of charter schools means the end of good quality public education, which is the one thing ever since the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation that white America did not want for blacks. That was education. Education empowers people because knowledge empowers. So the bigger issues, it was possible to elect a black president, but why is it not possible to reduce mass incarceration? Mm-hmm. Why is it not possible to end poverty? Why is it not possible to end housing discrimination? And these things have grown. These things have increased. And that's the majority. That's more people than one man becoming president. So that's very discouraging, that America has always found a way to suppress a whole category of people.
I just want to brief.
Maybe yeah. Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, is right. Yeah. We have created a permanent caste system. And we have locked them either in the ghetto or in jail, from which there is no escape. If that's true, then the job for our young 26-year-old mother is beyond formidable. But it must continue.
I want to turn just briefly to probably one of the most revolutionary things that has taken place, which, of course, is the gay rights movement. I have Michael Weber here from the Institute for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. And Michael, just a brief minute we have or so left. Obviously, there was Stonewall in 1969, I think it was. How much of a accomplishment are you surprised that the revolution has taken place, and how much do you think that's built on this civil rights tradition that King led?
I think we've definitely made a lot of growth since Stonewall, and I think that based on the civil rights movement in the 60s, we've been able to kind of build off that. We know what a civil rights movement looks like. We know what to expect from government leaders. We understand the pushback that's going to happen, which we use that to our advantage in order to progress marriage equality, which is one of the biggest accomplishments that's happened. But we're seeing a lot of backlash other places too, with discrimination laws and hate crime laws. There are only 14 states right now that cover both gender identity and sexual orientation in their discrimination policies, which really limits gay people to where they're able to live. And you know, there might be a great job opportunity in one state, but the discrimination laws don't match what is there in another state. So you might take a different job that may not fit your qualifications, but you're protected there. And I think that's one of the biggest fallback that we've had, is we've been able to progress marriage equality, but we're not able to protect people at work. We haven't been able to protect people on the streets. It's an ongoing process. And I think the gay rights movement has started to align themselves with the black rights movement or the African-American community in progressing these individual rights. We have these, you know, we have marriage equality. You're able to get a job, but we need those additional rights.
We've been speaking with Michael Weber. He's with the Institute for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement. Michael, we'll promise to have you back there. Charlotte King, also a chair of the Southern Delaware Alliance for Racial Justice. Amber Green with the Phoenix Youth Project, and James Yamakawa, the group Show Up for Racial Justice. This has been Delmarva Day. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Maryland General Assembly's 90-day session has gotten underway. The Free State is looking at a lot of red ink as the governor and the Maryland Democratic legislative leaders begin to spar in Annapolis. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Topping the agenda is a projected $544 million budget shortfall. Add to these woes, expect a battle between the governor and Democratic legislative leaders over the transportation legislation for allocating state funds. Discuss these and other issues this morning. We have in our studio delegate Mary Beth Carrozza. The Eastern Shore Republican sits on the House Appropriations Committee, so, of course, is familiar with the financial numbers coming out of Annapolis. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation, and so early in the session, so there's a lot to talk about. But I thought I'd also share with you, I'm excited that I have a couple of young people from Salisbury University that are supporting me in my office. My legislative aide is a Salisbury University graduate, Lewis Evans. He has come on board. And we have two interns in our office. I share an office suite with Delegate Teresa Riley from Hartford County. And she has a Salisbury University intern named Colin Sweeten. And also, I have a Salisbury University intern, Danny Walker. So if you walk in, I think folks back home will feel very welcome, feel very much at home.
But along those lines, what do you think they learn? What do you think they come away with? And what do they tell you they come away with?
I'll tell you, there is no replacement for actually being on site during the legislative session. And we involve our interns and our staff in all aspects of the operation. Anyone who comes and would like to do an internship with me, I underscore top priority is constituent service. I want, whether someone is emailing us, writing us, calling us, walking in the office without an appointment, I want them to feel welcome. And so that's something that we ingrain with our new interns from the beginning. Then they find they're involved in everything from doing some research on bills that either I may introduce or some of my colleagues have introduced but want me to be a co-sponsor. But before I do, I want to do my homework. I also ask them to, when they do their research, always get the angle from the Eastern Shore. Don't just go from the Department of Legislative Services. Call back home, find out what the impact of any proposed regulations or legislation might have on the Eastern Shore. They also are able to attend our committee hearings. I think that's a good way to actually see how the delegate that they're supporting and they're working for interacts with the chairman and with the other colleagues on the committee. And then sometimes we just need help. Just, you know, can you run this to another delegate who's waiting for a co-sponsorship or is waiting for some information? We also will ask them to attend some of the meetings with us, some of the receptions when groups come up from the Eastern Shore, so they can see that when constituents make the effort to come all the way up to Annapolis, that they have some opportunity to interact with them. So I believe that if they're smart about their time and maximize the internship, there's no substitute for it, and all those skills are transferable.
Well, no doubt they will have an interesting session, I think. I want to talk about the atmosphere up there at this point, because I know Mark Steiner recently held his Annapolis summit, and a couple of things that struck out at me. The Senate President Mike Miller talking about the governor saying he's gradually burning my bridges and he's never built bridges to House Speaker Michael Bush. Bush, I heard say, in terms of outreach, bipartisanship, Bush says he doesn't know who the governor's talking to. The governor, for his part, of course, says that he's being bipartisan and is just simply stealing Democratic ideas. What's going on in Annapolis there?
Well, I will always be an optimistic person, and we are going into our third legislative session, and we all know that will be tougher. We come in with some added pressure. You mentioned the deficit. The structural deficit for FY18 is $377 million. So that's the structural deficit for fiscal year 18. That puts a lot of pressure on Governor Hogan as he prepares his budget and the expectations of the legislature. So you have a little bit of that tension going in because of the budget challenges you mentioned. Then you have Governor Hogan, I believe, following through on his campaign promises. He is looking for initiatives that will continue to promote economic development and job growth. He is looking for bipartisan initiatives in the area of public safety. And when we do disagree, he's trying to point out why the positions he's taking are good for the entire state. I just believe that there's some inherent tension built in between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And it's probably underscored the fact that we had changes at the federal level that now will affect the state level. And we are now in our third legislative session, which is at the point where everybody's digging in a little bit more on their positions and what they want to accomplish in their four-year term.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that there is a dramatic difference in some of these initiatives, say, that the governor is proposing? You know, for instance, he was talking about manufacturing incentives as an example, and there was some dispute about that. Are they smaller differences, or why is it that, particularly why is it the Democratic leadership, and particularly Michael Bush, who was very strong about this, just said, hey, he's not reaching out. We're not getting this. I mean, you're sitting out there trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. Well, I guess I always start from representing my own area.
Right.
And in my area, Governor Hogan has deep, across-the-board bipartisan support in Worcester, Wicomico counties and Somerset counties, the whole lower shore. So I start from the area that I represent. And the reason I believe he has that deep support is because he is advancing ideas that affect the average Maryland family. So let's look at a couple of those ideas. One of them that I'm very excited about that Governor Hogan announced early in session, and I plan to co-sponsor the legislation, was the student debt relief bill. Now, this is, you know, this is good for families, Democrats, Republicans, not only on the shore, across the state, that basically this proposal will allow for 100% tax deductible for the student loan interest for individuals making $200,000 or less, and for couples making $250,000 or less. I can tell you by talking to families across the district that they are concerned about how they're going to fund their children's education. So now we have a proposal that was that will take some of that pressure off. In addition, Governor Hogan announced as part of his loan relief proposal, tuition relief proposal, to cap the tuition increase to 2%. The University of Maryland Systems was looking at a 5% increase, and Governor Hogan's legislation will cap that tax increase to the tuition increase to 2%. You look at that, that makes sense. It's responsive. It will have bipartisan support. And he does take the ideas of Democrats and Republicans. So part of this is you have a governor that is getting out there early with these proposals, and perhaps a leadership that, you know, maybe preferred to introduce those proposals on their own terms. Again, I go back to that natural tension between the executive and the legislative branches of government.
Just quickly, how much do you think this has to do with 2018? I know the governor, as a matter of fact, suggested that in the Annapolis summit.
Very interesting. Governor Hogan met with the Republican members of the caucus the day before session starts. It's a tradition we have. He had a very clear message to us, and his message to us was focus on the 2017, this legislative session. He is well aware that some members of the other party are more focused on 2018. And so I believe, again, that's where some of those tensions are coming. I am trying every day to get up to keep my eye on the ball, which is the current legislative session. But it's tough when you hear the speculation of who might run for governor, who might run for comptroller, et cetera. So I guess your point about 2018 being right out there, to a certain extent, with some of our members in the Maryland General Assembly, the campaign has already started.
But are you saying, in effect, this is the Democrats' problem? They're looking beyond. I mean, certainly a partisan observation, but nonetheless, I mean, or are you all looking on? Because one of the questions that will become, in particular in 2018, is whether or not this governor will get a second term, unlike, for instance, Bob Ehrlich.
Very good point. And as a former deputy chief of staff for Governor Ehrlich, I can tell you that 4 years is not enough to change and make dramatic long-term structural changes for the future of Maryland, which is why I support and totally believe that Governor Hogan needs two terms in order to advance and truly change Maryland for the long haul. And so back to your point, some of the work as we're focused on 2017, some are looking at it in terms of politically, how will this affect the campaign and election in 2018? I happen to believe that good government is good politics. And if we all keep doing our job and showing the results, showing that we're being responsive, showing that we're trying to work in a bipartisan way to advance shared priorities, then I believe that's going to pay off.
Let me ask you this. How do you square, and with the fact that you have this large budget deficit, how do you square that with the idea that, say, well, okay, we're going to give loan forgiveness because that's going to cost money, or capping tuition, that's going to cost money? How do you square that with the fact that you have this looming budget deficit?
That's an excellent point. And I, first of all, think we have to manage our expectations about any type of tax relief or tuition relief. So these proposals come in, and I would think that we would then start talking about what might be the realistic number. I am encouraged that at the end of last session, we had both of our leadership in the House of Delegates and the State Senate talking about tax relief. They couldn't agree on a fine. In the end, they couldn't agree. But the fact that we were even talking about tax relief with the leadership, that they were open to that and they just couldn't agree on what that final package or numbers might look like, I believe that bodes well that we may see some type of limited tax relief. But you're absolutely right. When we left session in April, we did not know about these deficits that came through. So your point about what realistically you can do, I would say that we would probably have to be more realistic about the numbers involved in any type of tax relief, tuition relief.
Because one of the things that Governor Hogan has said is that he would like to, I guess, in essence, eliminate this mandated spending that you've got. I mean, he says it's only like 17% that you can have discretionary and so on. Do you favor lifting that? And if so, what might that might mean in terms of the volatility of some of those programs that obviously are being funded through this mandated spending?
We have been talking about providing some type of mandated spending reform since my very first session in 2015. And why that is so important is because it is driving our spending and our future spending. So when you start to look at the budget and the I'd have to check the exact percentage, but it's I believe that we're in the 70% to 80% range of the spending being required, mandated. That means you have very little discretionary funds. And as far as making decisions on what you can do with that discretionary funds, this is one of the reasons why I am spending so much time attending the Kerwin Commission meetings. This is a commission that is looking at the education funding formulas, and they will make recommendations at the end of 2017. I want to make sure that if we're looking at changing funding formulas, number one, that they're fair to the shore. Because right now, if you look at particularly Worcester County, that puts in the most local support but gets the least amount from the state, there's something wrong when you're penalizing counties that are giving more local support and getting a little back from the state. So I first want to participate this in making sure our funding formulas are fair. The other reason I'm participating is I've been promoting career, trade, technology, education, and we'll come back to that because I want to go back to your question about mandated spending. From the very beginning, my first session in 2015, I have been raising the question with my chairman, Maggie McIntosh. So she's chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And, you know, the point being, instead of us looking at and examining more bills that require mandated spending, we should actually be looking at those bills, those mandated bills. Is there a way that we can open up the discussion to maybe look at the funding of that mandated spending and at the bare minimum not continue to support bills that force mandated spending? And unfortunately, that still has been occurring in the last two legislative sessions.
I can't let you go without talking about transportation. The transportation bill, you're smiling. I think they call it, some people, the critics call it the roadkill bill, I guess. I love the alliterations. Obviously, the Democratic leadership is saying they favor this. They say that it provides more transparency. The governor says there's a certain straitjacket quality to this. The Democrats say no, that it's advisory. And the final sort of piece of this is that I can't remember whether it was Miller or Bush said that, well, basically what's happening is that the governor is going out and building all these roads in the rural areas, which is great for us, right? But the road projects and the transportation projects in particular and the bigger areas, the city areas, aren't going to be getting that. And it been basically, they said, I think at one point one of them said, look, that's where Hogan's votes are. That's where he's going to put his transportation projects. Where are you on this transportation bill? Are you for or against it? Why does it, can it be reformed? What, I mean, who's, like, who's saying what, you know?
I'd like to talk a little bit about this because it's so important. Yeah. And it, to me, what, why it's so important is it comes back to local involvement. I became involved in this issue when a colleague of mine introduced legislation last session that would dramatically change the transportation scoring funding formula. And the proposal put more weight, gave precedence to populous areas, so therefore prioritizing urban and mass transit projects, therefore hurting road and highway projects across the state. When we had the debate on the House floor, I actually stood up and spoke on this issue. And I don't speak on a lot of issues, but I felt so strongly about it because I realized that none of our local elected officials or local highway folks involved in, you know, advancing these projects were ever consulted about this major transportation scoring formula that we're about to change. And I have participated in the local meetings in Wicomico County, in Worcester County, where the Secretary of Transportation comes down with his team. It's a public meeting. He meets with the local elected officials, the state delegates and state senators. The public is invited. And what they're trying to do is gauge locally to see what are the priority projects within the individual counties, how far along are they, so we know we can make good decisions about funding transportation projects. It's a system that worked. So when legislation was proposed to basically change, fundamentally alter that system that worked, that was based on fairness, that was based on inclusion of our local elected officials, to a formula that gives more weight to population centers, to urban areas, to mass transit systems, you realize that it would hurt the roads and transportation projects across the state, hence the term the roadkill bill. So I actually asked my colleagues on the House floor, and I looked at them and I said, I've checked with my local elected officials and no one consulted them about this new transportation funding formula. And I dare say if you ask your own in your own jurisdictions, they were not consulted either. And I could tell by the expressions on their face that that was the case. Unfortunately, we went ahead. That bill was passed. The legislature, the governor vetoed the bill, and the legislature, which within the same session, which rarely happens, they overrode the governor's veto within the same session. So what options did we have? So Governor Hogan and his team then take the time to look at this bill, the actual wording of the bill, to see how they're going to do these projects. And they realize that of the projects, of the road and highway projects that are on the books, that only six or seven of them statewide are going to meet the criteria of the new transportation scoring bill. So that was brought to, you know, the attention of the, you know, the bill drafters. And then the response from the legislature, particularly those leaders who supported the new system, said, well, we can tweak this. We can fix it. Well, again, when the Secretary of Transportation sat down with his team and looked at it, the bill is so bad that it can't be tweaked. It can't be revised. So Governor Hogan, who is open to changing the formula to address some of the concerns, is open to doing that after the legislature repeals the current transportation funding formula, which is why Governor Hogan, before session even started, introduced the bill that would repeal the new transportation scoring system. And that's why so many of us are on board saying we need to repeal this scoring system, but we are open to a system, whether it's like the state of Virginia or others, that has a little bit more criteria for determining these projects. We're open to that, but you first have to repeal a bad bill.
Well, let me ask you this. So is this a matter of, say, cities versus rural areas? One of the things, by the way, one of the things that has struck me a few years back was, Norm Conway, who was a delegate, sat on the House Appropriations Committee.
Chairman.
Right. He funneled money, and I could see the money coming in. He's obviously disappeared, obviously of a different party than yours. Did we lose something? Are we don't have as much clout as perhaps you think we should have on the Eastern Shore, particularly rural area, because it's obviously dominated by cities?
Well, number one, Governor Hogan has made it a priority, transportation infrastructure, road and highway projects, and he has made that a priority. And you can see that with the budget that he puts together. So number one, we have Governor Hogan, who is supporting transportation projects in the rural areas. Number two, if you look at our current delegation, we have senators and delegates that sit on key committees, transportation and environment. We have Delegate Charles Otto, Delegate Carl Anderton on the Senate Finance Committee.
Although they're not Democrats and they don't have that kind of clout, do they?
Well, that's a good point, but we also have Senator Mathias, who's on the Finance Committee. But the point being, they're on key committees where you can influence policy. And I, of course, am on the Transportation Committee and work in a bipartisan way with my colleagues. What concerns me about this transportation, this new transportation scoring system, some of the projects that are in jeopardy directly affect the shore. One of them is 404, coming to right into Wicomico County and to our reach the beach on 404. That project, the construction project closer to the Bay Bridge, is in jeopardy under this new transportation funding bill. Also, in my home county of Worcester County, the construction outside of the widening and improvements for 589 outside of Ocean Pines. Well, that's a critical safety project because the population base in Worcester County is in Ocean Pines. It also puts in jeopardy the Route 50 bridge coming into Ocean City, the future changes for that, and that affects everybody in the state of Maryland that visits Ocean City, and we like to think most Marylanders come to Ocean City for their vacation, and we'll continue to encourage that. So my point is, when you have a new scoring system that is putting in jeopardy those type of projects that are not only good for the shore but are good for the whole state, meaning that other Marylanders are enjoying the improvements to those projects, then we need to take the bigger view. And so I believe that we're going to have to push on this issue. It is an uphill battle. And, Governor Hogan and a team of us are going to continue to push for the repeal. If we are not successful with the repeal, we will find every means we can to make sure that those priority projects that are good for the shore and for the whole state will move forward in the future.
Just quickly, what about this idea that it's advisory? That's what I heard. That I heard the legislative leadership say that.
Well, I've heard that as well. But then when the Secretary of Transportation and his team actually look at the wording and their specific criteria, that seems to fly in the face of what the law actually states.
We'll turn to Salisbury, downtown Salisbury. As you know, we've got a new mayor, or it's been, I guess, in a few years, very vigorous, wants to, I talked to him just the other week, it sounds like he wants to reshape certainly Salisbury. What about funding, say, for the Main Street Master Plan, or do you think we'll be able to get funding for that? What do you see there?
Well, I appreciate both Mayor Day and County Executive Culver's approach to pushing their priorities in Salisbury and Wicomico County, because they come in organized. They do their homework. They find out they make sure they have the support. Mayor Day has the support in Salisbury. Bob Culver has the support in the county. They present that support. They have very detailed plans and time frames, and come in with, I believe, realistic requests. I was very encouraged that after the MACO conference in August, the Maryland Association of County Organizations, that when that wrapped up, the Secretary of Transportation was leaving Ocean City and headed to Salisbury specifically to meet with Mayor Day to talk about the Salisbury Main Street project. That's very encouraging. That tells you that the work is being done early on. That tells you of the interest of Governor Hogan's administration and the Secretary of Transportation. And I also understand there's been a lot of follow-up. As a matter of fact, I've been part of that follow-up since that initial meeting. I believe I would not be surprised that if Governor Hogan's budget comes out with some funding for one of the Salisbury projects, I would, you know, at least I'm encouraged by some of the preliminary conversations and certainly would continue to work with Mayor Day, with Governor Hogan's administration to see how I can be helpful on the Appropriations Committee to advance that project and those projects.
Two other things I want to ask you about. One is what they call concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs. As a matter of fact, it came up in the summit, but I've talked to a lot of folks about it. These, for our listeners, are large, fairly large poultry operations, which is apparently a response in part to the marketplace, but there are being placed too oftentimes, at least as far as residents are concerned, near residential areas that are out in the county, but they're certainly agriculturally zoned, but they seem different. And I know I talked to at least a couple people down in Somerset County who said, geez, this thing moved in and I can't, you know, I don't know whether I can plant anything because I don't know what the smell is going to be like. And of course, there's obviously the debate over the impact on health and so on. When I talked to Bill Satterfield with the Del Monte poultry industry, and I asked him, I said, put aside the scientific things, just the personal experience about, well, that this is happening to them. This is a real life experience. And he said he didn't know what to tell me. What's your sense about that? Because I don't get the sense that this is about we can't have CAFOs. It's about more about where they're going to be placed.
Right. I think the Wicomico County has taken a thoughtful approach to this. When this became a little bit more explosive when it was hitting the press earlier, I noticed that I heard from some constituents on this, and I know others did as well. I really respect the fact that the county executive and the county council had the public meetings, and that, first of all, it allows everybody to share their views. It also allows the opportunity to get the facts out there, to educate on there as well. And I made a point to continue to talk to John Cannon, our Wicomico County Council President, about where we would end up on that. And I really respect the approach and his leadership on it because he was in listening mode. It sounded to me like by working with the constituents who were concerned and the property owners, with the poultry industry, because we know how important not only the poultry industry, but all the related businesses to it are to our shore community. And my takeaway is that we were beginning to see some progress as far as breaking down these individual projects and working them. The rhetoric seemed to be toned down once we took that approach. And I really also depend on my colleagues on the Environment and Transportation Committee to let me know how these issues are possibly going to be worked at the state level. But so many times, I believe, we can work through these tough issues at a local level without legislation. When you get into legislation, I look at proposing bills as a last resort. You know, if that's the only way we can resolve something, you know, then we should take that approach. But if there are other ways that we can work through some of these issues, I think we should turn to those options first.
What do you say to, and I heard this actually at the summit, but what do you say to residents? And I know there were a number of residents that I talked to. It was right outside of Salisbury, actually, because there's a plan to CAFO out there, that one, that the, obviously the regulations they feel, the county a number of the counties, but including Wicomico, didn't go far enough. And at one point in that summit, somebody from Wicomico County says, "Our delegates, our representatives in Annapolis aren't listening. They're not listening." And and I'll tell you, when I talk to these residents, these are not environmentalists from the Western Shore. These are people who've lived here a long time, and then they see these things sort of move in, and they say, these regulations aren't enough. What do you say to them? What do you mean?
Well, sometimes I do believe that these issues become emotional, and we may not always agree on the same solution, but I can tell you that listening is a top priority for all of us, and we go to these meetings. We listen. We do a lot of one-on-one with our constituents, whether it's individual meetings, emails, phone calls. As a matter of fact, I take a lot of pride in being extremely accessible, as well as my colleagues, both Democrats and Republicans in the Shore delegation. So, you know, I believe that we're always in listening mode. I believe these are tough issues, too, that you have to work through. The fact that, you know, you're even talking about regulations in areas that might not have been regulated before is certainly progress to trying to address those concerns. And as far as, you know, some of the regulations not going far enough, you know, I think to the extent that we can try to see how they might be affecting individual people or families or property owners, to see if there is any leeway, that we should try to do that. But I think that's also, there's always going to be an inherent tension, just like the one we talked about between the executive and legislative branch, between people who want regulations to go so far and others who say, you know, if they go too far, they're actually going to hurt in other areas. So it's a balancing act, but, you know, I can assure my constituents that I'm always in listening mode, and I always try to find a consensus approach. I take pride in that, and I know that's how my colleagues in the Shore delegation approach our challenges on the Shore as well.
The last issue I wanted to ask you about, obviously we're going to have a new administration in Washington, much different than the old administration. No doubt we'll probably see some cuts in government spending and so on and so forth. But one of the issues is, of course, the Affordable Care Act. Maryland participated in the Medicaid expansion. Apparently, it's been growing at a fairly rapid clip. And there's been suggestion, I think it was by Senator Rand Paul, that they may just try to leave all this funding to the states, and they can, if they want to raise taxes, they can do it. What's your sense about where, particularly that piece of it's going? I mean, obviously, we have the exchange as well. Are you willing to try to find the financial resources to fill in to keep that Medicaid expansion, and are those resources there, or are we going to find a few years from now, if they decide to repeal and not replace that piece of it, that a lot of your constituents, particularly on Medicaid, or even the people in exchanges, will be out of luck?
Well, first of all, let's start by the premise that health care is an extremely complex issue. I took some time this summer. I don't do a lot of conferences, but the one I took this summer was one on Medicaid, just to try to get smarter on the issue because of the impact that you just mentioned. So if we start from the standpoint that we have a new administration at the federal level that's committed to repealing the Affordable Care Act, repeal or replace, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
I have kept my focus on Maryland. So you're absolutely right. So what does all this mean for the state of Maryland? Right now, we don't know. So anyone who's speculating that they know that people are going to be thrown off their health care insurance, or people who have Medicaid now or just got on the Medicaid expansion no longer will have that, number one, that's false, because we don't know. The feds have not made their decisions on how they're going to move forward on changing the Affordable Care Act, which means if they haven't made those changes and decisions at the federal level, we certainly don't know at the state level. However, We have good leadership that has already begun to think about what the possible ramifications could be. We have a new Secretary of Health and Mental Hygiene. His name is Dennis Schrader. I actually served with him in Governor Ehrlich's administration. This is somebody that understands policy, programs, operations, and he also understands the political. He is in a leadership position where he's going to understand that what they do at the federal level, we have to make sure it doesn't hurt what we've been doing at the state level. I've had those conversations with him. That's the approach he's planning to take. As well as we have a new chairman of the health committee in the House of Delegates. Delegate Pendergrass, woman chairman of the health committee. This is huge too, because now she's in a leadership role. She's new to her position. So I'm looking at it, because I tend to be an optimistic person, that you have new leadership at the federal level. You have a new leader at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene for the state of Maryland. And you have a new chairman in the House of Delegates for health. And that if all of us have a shared priority, which is whatever they do at the federal level, we want to make sure it doesn't have a negative impact at the state level. If we can, first of all, agree that that's a shared priority, it first puts people in leadership positions able to then work through these tough issues. But I have to tell you, they are tough issues, and we have budget challenges, and there will be changes. We have to just make sure we're smart about the changes we make in the state of Maryland.
Do you think that, I mean, if we do lose money, for instance, expansion and so on, or even subsidies for them, is the state really capable of making sure that those people who would be affected will get some kind of health care? I mean, do we really have the financing? Do we really have the structure? I mean, do we have the resources? Because there's a big difference between a state government which has to balance its budget every year and the federal government.
Well, that's an excellent point. And you're right to point out our one constitutional responsibility as members of the General Assembly is to make sure that we have a balanced budget. And so that's the one job that we have to do during the 90-day legislative session. But to your point about how this will impact people, real people. My experience so far, particularly in working in the healthcare arena, I am on the healthcare subcommittee on appropriations. So the department and all the different agencies dealing with healthcare come before my subcommittee. My experience so far is that we have been a leader. Maryland has been a leader in serving the population that needs assistance in this area. But we're also trying to be smart about it. And that one of the reasons why I did go to this conference out of state to focus on Medicaid is because I had the opportunity to go with our Maryland Medicaid director, who, by the way, is admired by other states, and they turn to us on the progress that we've been making. And having the opportunity to go to this conference with her, and these very complex funding issues on healthcare would come up, and I was able to literally turn to her and say, Shannon, what does this mean for us in Maryland?
Right.
We have talented people in Governor Hogan's administration. We have experienced legislators, Democrats and Republicans. Delegate Cherie Sample Hughes from the area here is on the Health Policy Committee. I'm on the Appropriations Health Subcommittee. So we have people in place that are trying to take a thoughtful approach to what will be some very serious changes that will affect health care across the state of Maryland. Again, I'm encouraged because I believe that we're not taking any knee-jerk reactions. Those who say that, you know, everybody's going to be thrown off the rolls or no longer will have health care insurance, that's just not the case. And I am committed to working through this in a thoughtful way to make sure we make good decisions for the people of Maryland, but also good, sound, fiscally responsible decisions as well.
We've been speaking with Delegate Mary Beth Carrozza, Republican, Eastern Shore. Appreciate you stopping by. You also sit on the House Appropriations Committee, so we expect to hear from you maybe midway through the session. Maybe we'll check back in and try to find out what's been going on.
That would be terrific. I would like to come back, and I thank you for taking this time. There's a lot going on right now in this session. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of these really important issues for Maryland.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.